Okay. Okay, so I was trying to figure out how to accurately describe what we're going to be doing in this class, because as we go mitzvah by mitzvah, obviously we're not going to cover all the different aspects of each mitzvah. It's impossible. And, you know, Bris Milah is something that has been covered over and over again, and you can go at it from a lot of different angles. So we're not really delving into like all the nitty-gritty halachic aspects of how that particular mitzvah is done. We're more doing like a kind of philosophical overview about what the mitzvah is about, and we'll get into some of the details when it's relevant to that discussion, but we really want to do a mitzvah per class, so we're not going to get into all the nitty-gritty, but I certainly welcome you to do that on your own. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about Bris Milah. So last week we talked about the first mitzvah in the Torah, the mitzvah of Pu'urvu, of being fruitful and multiplying. And now we get mitzvah number two. Like we said last week, there's only three mitzvot in the entire book of Bereishis. And this is number two. So the first time this mitzvah is mentioned is on page 72 in our Art Scroll Chumashim, beginning of Perek Yud Zayin of the 17th chapter. It says, when Avram was 99 years old, Hashem appeared to Avram and said to him, I am El Shaddai, walk before me and be perfect. I will set my covenant between me and you, and I will increase you most exceedingly. Avram threw himself upon his face, and God spoke with him, saying, as for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be a father of a multitude of nations. Your name shall no longer be called Avram, but your name shall be Avraham. For I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you most exceedingly fruitful, and make nations of you, and kings shall descend from you. I will ratify my covenant between me and you, and between your offspring and you, throughout their generations, as an everlasting covenant, to be a God to you and to your offspring after you, and I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojourns, the whole of the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I shall be a God to them. But there's only one catch. God said to Avram, and as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. Dun, 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 dun. You shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and that shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. At the age of 8 days, every male among you shall be circumcised throughout your generations. He that is born in the household or purchased with money from any stranger, a convert, or I mean, he's talking about slavery, and I can get the slavery now, who is not of your offspring. Okay, let's stop there. Okay, so how would you describe in your own words what these psukim are saying?
It's basically saying that circumcision marks the covenant.
Okay, circumcision marks the covenant. How would you describe what the circumcision is, the purpose of it, the way we've seen it? How would you describe it?
It seems like you're making an agreement to bind yourself to God, I guess, so to speak.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of seems like God's striking a deal, right? It's interesting because it doesn't start off with Avram's responsibility. It starts off with God's responsibility, right? God's going to do this. It's just that here's the catch. Right? Here's the deal. So we want to understand the purpose of what Avram's committing to in his end, right? After Hashem, after God, says what God's ready to commit to. So what is Hashem ready to commit to?
Making Abraham a great nation.
Okay, many nations, right? Great
nations will descend.
We'll have this special relationship. I will give you and your offspring after the land, right? You're going to get the land of Israel. It sounds too good to be true, right? You know what they say, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. So look what he gets. He gets to be a father of a multitude of nations. He has this special relationship with God. He gets his own land, right? Okay, so I'm asking you to do this. You know, most people, if God came to them and offered them this deal, would they take it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, right? And this is, you know, it's a pretty good deal. It's a pretty good deal. All in all, it's a pretty good deal. But what Hashem asks of Avram is kind of a strange request, right? It seems to be an unusual way to go about this. So we have to understand, first of all, why Avram has to do it, and why his future generations have to do it, right? Avram's getting the deal, right? Avram's getting to be the forefather of all of this nation. His future generations are the offspring, but they don't have the same recognition as Avram is going to. So Avram's committing future generations to this deal, right? It's not just his deal, it's their deal too. Yeah, Jay?
So to have a contract, though, I mean, you have to have consideration on both parts, right? You can't just have a contract and there's no value to the other party.
Okay. So what value is this to Hashem?
We don't ask these kinds of questions.
Oh, in this class we ask these kinds of questions. That's exactly the kind of questions that we ask.
So, I mean, really looking at it from my viewpoint, the only thing that it does is it physically identifies people.
Okay, so I'm making you different. I'm making you a separate nation. So
I'm giving you this land, and you have to, you know, wear the Hashem tattoo.
Okay.
It's not exactly a tattoo.
But there's a lot of ways that, you know, it could have been a tattoo. It could have been a Jewish star on your arm. It could have been, I don't know, you have to wear red every Thursday. I mean, you can come up with all sorts of things.
Right.
Right? Instead, it's the Bris Milah. So is it just some random request that God makes of us that there's some physical demonstration?
You're not going to be able to, like, marry a woman and pull her into thinking you're Jewish when you're not.
So it's to avoid intermarriage?
It could help.
It could help. It doesn't help the women. Right? So the Jewish women can intermarry.
See, they don't have a mark. Which is also an interesting question.
Okay,
right, if it's a mark for the people and all your offspring,
then
why is it only the men?
Why is it only 50% of the generation of the population? Okay, that's a good question. We'll get to that as well. Okay, so we have this request, but it flows in one sense. It flows that Avram is having this conversation with Avram and not with Sarah.
That is true.
Right? So, which is also part of the question, because Avram and Sarah are seen as a team in a very significant way. Why is Sarah not in this? Now, it's interesting because the next verse, right after Hashem describes this whole process of circumcision, verse 15 says, "And God said to Avram, as for your Sarai, your wife, do not call her name Sarai, for Sarah is her name. I will bless her indeed. I will give her a son through her. I will bless her, and she shall give rise to nations, kings and peoples to rise from her." So Hashem makes clear that this applies to your wife, to Sarah, is equally as Avram. She gets the same deal. She gets the same perks. She gets her name changed too. Right? Just she doesn't have to go through what you have to go through. Right? Yeah, Sarah's probably not complaining about her side of the arrangement. She seems to get all the perks without having to go through what he has to go through. Okay. So, number one, we have a few elements of this. Okay, so let's see. What are the elements that we have of this? And so, let's go back to the first line here. Number one, two. Well, let's go to Pasuk Aleph. Vayi Avram ben Tishim Shana v'Teisha Shanim v'Yira Hashem el Avram v'Yomer Lav Ani El Shaddai Hitalech Lifanai v'Hayet Hamim. When Avram was 99 years old, Hashem appeared to Avram and said to him, "I am El Shaddai. Walk before me and be perfect. I will set my covenant between me and you, and I will increase you most exceedingly." Okay, so let's take that as the heading, right? As the what's the term that every English teacher uses when you write an essay? The
thesis statement.
There we go. Thesis statement. Still have nightmares. Okay. My English teacher never. And he just never liked me. That's interesting.
You only had one English teacher?
What? No. Well, this is the way it works. I wonder if this works everywhere. When we had female English teachers, the boys always got better grades than the girls. When we had male English teachers, the girls always got better grades than the boys. Like, wide disparities.
My English teachers were all tyrants and gave no one good grades.
Okay, so maybe it could have been worse than you're saying. Okay, where were we? Okay, so,
walk before me and be perfect.
Okay, so what are the elements of this thesis statement? Let's break them down. As Hashem's about to explain this deal to Avram, what are the key elements of this deal as laid out in the thesis statement?
Basically, what you just said, walk before me and be perfect.
Okay, so that's one. Okay, so we have
Be perfect.
Okay.
That's easy enough. Okay. Be perfect. What else?
Well, I guess walk before me would be something different. It says walk before me and be perfect.
Okay.
Right.
Right. Walk this way.
Isn't Aerosmith playing? In the...
All right, number two. What else?
There is going to be a covenant. There will be a covenant between
okay.
God and man.
Okay, so we have a covenant. What kind of covenant? We don't really know, but some sort of covenant.
Mm-hmm. At this okay. point, it's just between Abraham and...
Right, so a covenant between Abraham... Right, in the thesis statement... Later on, though, it talks about how it's going to be between future generations
yes,
as well.
But at this point...
Yeah. Okay, so we have, walk before me, be perfect, I will set my covenant, and I will increase you most exceedingly. Okay, so the third element is many offspring. Okay?
Now, the question is, do we know, is many offspring subordinate to the covenant, or are they just two options we're getting at here?
Say that again? As many offspring...
Subordinate to the covenant, right? Do we have to have the covenant for there to be many offspring, or can do we know at this point? Are we just saying...
It seems like it.
And, you know...
It seems like... It seems like Hashem's saying, okay, I'm ready to give you all this, but you gotta play ball, right? We gotta... But we have to be on the same page here. So he'll get this, but yeah, it does seem like that's a prerequisite for that. Yeah. The covenant is a prerequisite for many offspring. Or at least many illustrious offspring.
You just have to be perfect.
What?
You just have to be perfect.
You just have to be perfect. Okay, right? So let's take these three things as the basis of understanding what a Brit Milah is about. Number one, to be perfect and to walk with me. Number two, to have a covenant with Hashem. And number three, that you'll have many offspring, not just offspring, illustrious offspring, right? There's kings, and then there's going to be a land in there eventually, right? For now, I'll just put that together, right? You'll get a land, right? Because you have so many offspring, they're going to need somewhere to live, right? Your house is going to get too big, so you need to have a whole country. So pretty soon, you'll have all of this, okay? So if you're going to get all this, and Hashem is kind of making a deal with you, so in some way, we'd assume, could be wrong, but let's assume that Avram's part of the deal has to reflect these three things, okay? So the Brit Milah is going to have to reflect these three things, okay? Alright, I forgot to tell a story in the beginning. I was going to open with a story and I forgot. Alright, well, I'll tell this story just because, you know, as we lead into the Brit Milah part, is that, you know, what makes the Brit Milah interesting is how it's remained such a central component of Jewish life, right? As we're talking about this covenant, we're going to get into, you know, how it's connected. So the story in my wife's family is that her oldest brother was born on an Air Force base in New Mexico. Right, my father-in-law, he's a dentist, but he was working for the Army, and he is, you know, Air Force base in New Mexico. So we're going to find a moyel in the Air Force base in New Mexico, and they made that close around. So they found this moyel in Texas, El Paso. I think he was living in El Paso, or he could get to El Paso. And the Moyle's deal was, I'll come, but I need a fighter jet to pick me up. that was the deal, right? Talking about making deals. So they did it. The Army paid for a fighter jet to pick up the Moyle, fly him into the Air Force base in New Mexico, and then fly him out. It's like, okay, that'll do it. You know, that'll do it.
Did he charge also for that?
Did he charge for the prison also? Yeah, you think that would be good enough, right? I don't know. But what's interesting is you know, that story, you know, besides the Air Force base part, but, you know, when I met my wife's parents the first time, I mean, it's always one of the first stories that they tell everybody. You meet someone, it's like one of the first stories that comes out. So it's one of the first stories I heard. But they also pointed out how significant the Bris was in their kind of becoming more observant, becoming more interested in Judaism. Because, you know, they kind of, you know, hadn't been that connected, and this start the process of them becoming much more connected. And you see with a lot of families, I mean, having children in general does that. But a bris, it's such a profound experience that it really, you know, becomes a part of that.
I'm ever involved in one myself, I'll let everyone know what that's like.
God willing.
God willing, God willing. Till then, the girls keep coming. All right.
Daughters are better than sons.
Yeah. What?
Daughters are better than sons.
Much better.
Not complaining. I just said, if one day I do a breast, that's fine. Okay. The funny thing is, when my wife was pregnant with the first of our three daughters, so I was in the Gris Kollel in Jerusalem, and we were with these young couples, all these newly married couples, and like there was literally, we did the math afterwards, there was like two babies born a month in this group, just because it's all these like newlyweds. So there's like all these brises, and we were like the last one. Our Tehila was born in July 4th, actually. So like, as we're getting closer, I was always the guy who stands in the back of the room during a bris. I couldn't be close. I couldn't be near. My parents had like 5 minutes of trying to convince me to be a doctor, and I can't handle it. So I'm the guy in the back of the room in the bris. But they kept the deal was every bris that we went to that year, I'd move like a little closer, because I kept saying if it's a boy, I can't be in the back of the room. So every like bris, I'd be like another 5 feet closer. Till by the end, I was like right up close, and then it was a girl and didn't matter anyway. But okay.
Maybe you save yourself a fainting job.
No, but it's good. But now that I'm a rabbi, I have to be up close. So it's good that I did that, because now now I can stomach it. You know, it's a good thing.
The first time you do it with your own son, you faint.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure your own's a different experience. But other people's sons, yeah, do whatever you want.
No, that's true.
Okay, so let's go through this step by step. Be perfect and to walk with Hashem. So what does the bris have to do with being perfect? So it's a very interesting midrash. It is in it's in Avos de Rabbi Nassan, which is kind of like Pirkei Avos, chapter 2, number 5, Mishnah 5, that says that Adam, when Adam was born, right? Adam Arishon, the first man. So how was he born? Was he born with a foreskin or not? So it says he was born without a foreskin, right? He was born without it, and then after he sins and the whole episode of the sin, and he's kicked out of the Garden of Eden, then a foreskin grows. Very interesting midrash.
On him.
Yeah, and then in future generations. That originally there was no foreskin, and then afterwards it grows on. Interesting. Why would that be? So here we get into the concept of some of the symbolism of the bris milah. So there's a midrash, another midrash, in get the source here. It's in Parshas Tazria, and there's a give and take between Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus, who was a Roman general. And Turnus Rufus, I mean, the bris milah, the circumcision, has always been one of the things that distinguished the Jewish people as being different. And not just, it was a physical sign, it was just seen as like a weird thing that Jews did, right? And there's all these stories from throughout history, that was the Jewish thing, right? That was the Jewish thing. Even back to the Holocaust, you hear stories about people who were on the run, or trying to run away from the Nazis. I mean, that was a way or the way they would check whatever side you were on. If it was someone claiming to be Jew and they wanted to take you in, or vice versa, that was a way you check. So he asks Rabbi Akiva, why do you do this? Right? And he didn't just say, why do you do this? He says, philosophically, it doesn't make sense. Because the bris milah seems to imply that you think God didn't do a good job in creating the world. Right? God creates people one way, and you're changing it. Right? And there's some truth to that, because there are other prohibitions in the Torah about changing our appearance in permanent ways. Having tattoos, you can't cut off a limb, you can't do certain things that change your appearance. There's different reasons for that, and that's a simplistic perspective. But there are certain things that the Torah prohibits. So he asks Rabbi Akiva, why is it that you have this mitzvah of circumcision? So Rabbi Akiva asks him, right? A Jew answers a question with another question. So he says to him, let me ask you, if I brought you a stalk of wheat and I brought you a loaf of bread, which one would you rather have? Right? So of course you'd rather have the loaf of bread. He says, I don't understand. God created the wheat. Man created the bread. So shouldn't we say that the wheat is more perfect than the bread? But we'd all pretty much say that the bread is more perfect than the wheat. The wheat is only there for us to use it and then make it into bread. But the wheat by itself is pretty useless, right? There's not much you can do with the stalk of wheat in and of itself. So he says that the same thing with the human body is that the mitzvah of Bris Milah is Hashem's way of telling us that God gives us the tools and now we have to take it from there. Right? That we're part of the creating experience. Right? It's our job to take the Torah that God gives us, to take the resources that God gives us, and then we have to take it from there and be partners in creation. We don't just say, well, God created me this way, this is who I am, this is what I am. Right? And we don't look at the world that way. In general, you know, we believe that people can change, that people can improve, that you're not limited or you're not limited based on your circumstances or, you know, things external to yourself. You have the ability to change who you are. And then Bris Milah is supposed to be the ultimate symbol of that. Right? And that's how he basically answers it. So it's an interesting perspective, but that ends up being what number one is about. That the Bris Milah is supposed to be a sign that we can become perfect, that we can follow in Hashem's ways. Right? It's really a philosophical statement. We don't believe that man, that God creates man, and based on fate or based on destiny, that's who you will be. Right? You're predestined to be something or someone. No, we don't believe that. We can even change the physical body. Right? From the moment a person is born, they receive the message, and everyone who's at their birth receives the message that we can change, that we're not limited based on our circumstances. So, that's number one. Any questions or comments on that?
So why that specific part?
Oh, we'll get to that. Okay. Well, I'll use it as a segue, Sam Carr.
Fancy.
Well, now I'm on the internet.
I can edit this. So not yet. Okay. Not yet. All right. So let's connect this to the previous mitzvah. What was the first mitzvah that we received in the Torah?
Be fruitful
and multiply. Okay, how do we describe the purpose of that mitzvah? Well, a lot of different ways. But what was the purpose of the mitzvah? The purpose of the mitzvah was to do what?
Just to tame the earth.
Okay, so we said it's the way the pasuk reads it, describes it, it's to be fruitful and multiply, but it doesn't stop there. What else does it say? Fill the earth and conquer it. Right? We're supposed to, right, umilua ta'aretz, spread out, fill up the earth, and take control of the world, meaning it's we should, you know, human beings end up becoming the ones who run the world, right? And if we're nice, we'll let other species coexist with us, if we're nice to them, right? If we decide that we want that to happen. But basically, we're the ones who control the world, right? It's, you know, we're the ones who have to decide, you know, to what extent we're, you know, and that's a big part of what's going on today, you know, environmentalism and all this. You know, we have to decide to what extent we're willing to pull back from our control of the world to allow other things to coexist with us, you know, how much we're ready to give. So, there's one thing that's missing, though. Or there's a key part that's missing to that mitzvah, right? What is that? What do you do then, right? So you've been fruitful and you've multiplied. And you spread out across the entire world. And you're spread out throughout the entire earth, right? You're even living in, you know, Nebraska. Right? And then what's step number three? Now you're conquering the world and you're taking it over and your humanity reigns supreme, right? Now what? Now what? Now what do you do? You can't conquer. There's nothing left to do. Your job is over.
Keep it up.
Keep building. But for what purpose? To what end? Why are we doing all this, right? It stops at that point. So mitzvah number two of Bris Milah is piggybacking on the first mitzvah, right? It's telling you what the next step is. What's the next step? Now perfect the world, right? Don't stop there. Your job isn't to just be fruitful and multiply and have, you know, fill the world and conquer it, and now make it a better place, and now do something with that world. Perfect it and walk with me, walk with Hashem, right? So this is stage two. Stage two, right, so if you look at the first two mitzvahs as linked, it makes, I think, a lot more sense. So that's why this is mitzvah number two of all things, because it's connected to mitzvah number one, right? We pointed out last week how mitzvah number one was given to the entire world, right? It's given to Adam and Eve. There's no Jews, they're not Jewish, right? This is way before we have any concept of a mitzvah in the Torah and the Jewish people. When do we get this mitzvah? Right? When do we give the mitzvah of Bris Milah?
When it becomes a Jewish nation,
right.
I guess.
This is the beginning stages of the Jewish nation. God's making the deal with Avraham, right? They're forming this relationship. Okay, this is what we're going to do. This is how Hashem's going to interact with us, right? The Jewish people are stage two of creation, right? The Torah is stage two of creation, right? Okay, now that we have this world, and now that it's spread out, and now that we have all this, okay, now Hashem's saying to Avraham, okay, you're handpicked to make this world a better place and to teach others how to do that. Right? So right from the outset, the mitzvah of Bris Milah isn't just about him, isn't just about the 8-year-old boy who's getting the bris. It's about us having a constant reminder. Right?
8 years now?
What is it, 8 years?
Yeah.
8 days, sorry.
Maybe a little more
painful. I was in such a groove. All right.
That explains the be perfect part. But walk this way is still...
Well, they're really connected. Meaning, if you want to be perfect, you have to walk with Hashem.
Walk before me.
Walk before... What's the exact terminology
walk,
here?
Yeah, walk before
me. Hitalech lefanai. Yeah, walk before me.
That means he's got our back. Is that it?
Well, it means that we're... That follow on Hashem's ways. If you want to know how to be perfect, follow in God's ways, and then you'll know what it means
but
to...
At this point, we don't know
better.
What God's ways are, do we?
Oh, well, that's the rest of the book. Right? He's giving us the starting point. Okay, that... I mean, Avram doesn't really understand Hashem yet, and that becomes clear in the stories that are going to take place very shortly, that Hashem has a lot of questions, right? A lot of questions. Hashem tries to understand what Hashem's doing with Sodom. Hashem doesn't understand why he doesn't have a son. And Sarah certainly doesn't understand how this is working.
Avram
and Sarah, saying that they don't understand how this is working. And then we see at the end of the Parsha, Hashem asks him to sacrifice his son. He doesn't know what's going on. This is the beginning of the relationship, right? Basically, the way any relationship begins is you get to know someone, you think you get close with them, and then you realize that they're going to do a lot of things that you don't understand. And you have to try to figure it out as you go along, right? As much as you think you know somebody, you know, as they say, when you get married, that's when the relationship really begins, right? Okay, now you really get to know them. Until then, you kind of know them, but you know, they're always holding back something. So to hear now, Hashem and Avram are really going to get to know each other, and Avram's going to ask the question. But you have to start off with the premise that I want to get to know Hashem. I want to follow in Hashem's ways. I don't understand what that means yet, but we're going to get there, right? So this is stage two of the creation process, right? And the Bris Milah is also stage two of the creation process. Hashem creates mankind, and the Bris Milah, at the most fundamental level, is continuing the creation of the human body. It's stage two of creation. We are now joined at the hip in God with creation. God creates man one way, and Hashem says, okay, now I want you to finish it off. In essence, what we're doing is we're bringing us back to the way Adam was. Adam was made this way. So now our job is to kind of bring us back to that point. Question, yeah?
Why did he wait till Abraham?
Why did he wait till Abraham to introduce this?
Yes.
He needed the right person. He needed the right person at the right time. Yeah. Noah was probably the second best candidate, but he didn't think he was ready for that. He didn't think he was the one. You know, he was waiting for that person who was going to step up on their own to be willing to make that sacrifice. And then so that's what it comes down to, is God chooses Abraham and not by only after Abraham proves himself to a certain degree, to a very strong degree.
And also just like on that note, Abraham was the first one who kind of like went out of his way to try to find God and like really start like rationalizing the world and thinking about it, reasoning, and then trying to do something about it.
Right. Right, exactly. Abraham takes a lot of steps before God even approaches him. Abraham is in an advanced stage in life, right? And he's not handpicked as a baby with miraculous, wise men coming to the barn house to say you're the one, right? You've been chosen to be the one, right? It's much more impressive. Abraham has to prove himself. Abraham is born like anybody else and only becomes Abraham on his own, and then Hashem says, "Okay, now I'm ready to partner with you. Now let's make this nation together." But you know, Avram's got to take the first steps. Okay, now why is the sign there, right? Why is the sign the bris milah in the place that it is. Well, to a certain extent, we just explained it, right? Because if it's stage two of creation, right? If the first mitzvah is be fruitful and multiply, right? And now the question is, okay, now that we've been fruitful and we've multiplied, now what do we do? Oh, we have to perfect the world. Well, if it's connected to be fruitful and multiply, then it's in the perfect place, right? That's number one. Number two, if it's be perfect and walk with me, right? So we have a part of the human body that does two things at once. In one sense, it is the beginning of procreation, beginnings of a mitzvah and bringing the next generation. And also, I hear from time to time, people make some pretty stupid mistakes in the area of sexuality. From what I hear, that's what David Letterman tells me. So, right? So, people just, you know, that this ends up being, in one sense, the ultimate mitzvah and the ultimate way of partnering with God. And in the flip side, ends up being the thing that can take you furthest away from God if you fall into temptation, if you become consumed by it. And it ends up being the thing that brings down people more than anything else. Right? And so, you, with the area of sexuality, you have two sides of the same coin. And you have to decide in the most extreme way, are you going to sanctify it or are you going to fall to the baser instincts of it? So in that sense, it's the perfect place to make this sign because it becomes the very symbol, the very definition of the choice that you're going to make throughout your entire life. You're going to be, if you're going to perfect it, you're going to walk with Hashem, so how are you going to handle this? How are you going to handle the area of sexuality? That ends up becoming, you know, one of the most difficult challenges that we're going to have. I mean, there's a beautiful, you know, King David says that this ends up also being a mitzvah that's always with you, right? Since it's a physical sign in your body itself, so it's a mitzvah that, you know, he says that, you know, even in, when you literally, you know, have nothing else on, it's a constant mitzvah that's always with you, and we need that constant reminder. Okay. So let's get to the idea of the covenant. Okay, and we'll see these two or three are pretty linked. Now the concept of a covenant, what does a covenant mean?
A bond? It's a contract.
It's an agreement.
It's a bond, a contract, an agreement. Okay. So we need two sides to be part of this arrangement. What other covenants do we see in the Torah? Well, this term bris is used. This isn't the only time. This isn't even the first time. When is the first time the Torah describes a covenant? Between God and Noah, right? The sign of the rainbow is a covenant, is a bris, between a sign that God's no longer going to destroy the world the way he did the first time. And it comes up again and again and again. So this becomes, so the concept of a bris, of a covenant, is not new, and this isn't the only time that we see it, but this is probably the most well-known, right? It gets known as the bris, so it's kind of the most well-known example of it. Now, if you I'll give another example. If you turn here to in Vayikra, let's get the page real quick. Page 552. So, Parshat Vayikra, Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Gimel, second chapter, verse 13. So, we'll do it in Hebrew, then in English. V'kol karban min chatzcha b'melech timlach, v'lo tashbid melech brit elohecha, me'al min chatecha, al kol karbancha takriv melech. You shall salt your every meal offering with salt. You may not discontinue the salt of your God's covenant from upon your meal offering. On your every offering shall you offer salt. So here we have another covenant that when you offer a sacrifice, a meal offering, you have to salt it, right? And if you remove the salt, you're removing the covenant. Seems to be a very different kind of covenant. So the Malbim, it was more of a contemporary commentary in the Torah, so he takes this and kind of says, well, you know, we can learn something about the concept of a covenant from here. What does salt do? What's the purpose of salt typically, besides, you know, making your food taste a little better? It's a preservative, right? It's there to make things last for much longer. So if you understand the covenant, that what's the purpose of a covenant? Purpose of a covenant is to make something stronger and longer lasting. Okay? So a covenant between a man and a wife, that a marriage is a covenant, right? You're making a deal, right? You're making a deal between two parties. And the idea is, okay, now we're saying this is for the rest of our lives, right? That's what you're doing. You're cementing the arrangement and saying this is going to be long-lasting. So too, that's what a covenant is. So he learns from here that the definition of a covenant is something that's going to make it long-lasting. And that's what Hashem wants to do with Avraham. Hashem's goal with Avraham is not to just have a good personal one-on-one relationship, as he makes very clear. The goal of his relationship with Avraham is that the next generation, and then the next generation, and the next generation, he has that same relationship with them. Now, that's not so simple, right? You know, anyone, you know, if you've just seen a family trying to pass a business down from one generation to the next, right? Or a family fortune, or an estate, more often than not, it ends up being quite a mess, quite a disaster, right? It's very difficult to pass something down from one generation to the next. Now, Hashem has Avraham. He doesn't have any kids yet, right? And now he's making a deal with Avraham that he wants to last for thousands of years. How in the world is that going to happen? Right? I mean, the odds of that happening are so unlikely. He doesn't have a following. You know, we have to realize, he doesn't have a following, right? Most religions, how do they start? Right? How does Islam start, right? So you have Muhammad, who develops a huge following, so that by the time Muhammad dies, right, he's got a whole system of followers who are there to kind of take over the mantle. And then, you know, you already have the masses involved, and then it's much easier to pass down to the next generation. When Avram dies, how many people are there for the next generation? One. Right? And then the next generation, one more. Right?
Which makes it odd if he was going to make nations out of them.
What do you mean?
If God said, I will make nations out of your offspring, they didn't start out very well.
It's kind of started slow.
It's a very slow starting process. Exactly. You'd think that Avraham should have taught thousands and thousands of people who become his devoted followers, and they take on the mantle to the next generation, and then it goes to, you know, and then it spread quickly.
But this is a hereditary.
Right, it's your offspring, right? You just
it's
can't go out
offspring. You just can't go out and collect people and say, be my followers.
Exactly.
You have to have your offspring do it. And when you only have one offspring, it's hard to have a lot of generations
But what's the flip side? The flip side is, it's created in a much firmer ground, right? Because now it's not just a religion, it's a family business. It's our family. The entirety of the Jewish people comes from Avraham, and then eventually converts who end up becoming part of that. But the initial stages of it are family. It's a family. I mean, obviously, you know, the 12 tribes marry women who are not in the family. They marry other women, and slowly but surely it builds up. It's, you know, but the core group is always the family, right? And it builds off of that. So they build internally, slowly but surely builds out. It's a very different concept of how to build up these mass numbers, right? That becomes the Jewish people. Really the exact opposite of the way you'd normally do it, right? What you want to do is you want to build up numbers quickly so you've got a mass following and then let it grow from there. But here it's the exact opposite. It's very slow.
Well, this way there's only one perspective of the story while it gets passed down, unlike Islam or Christianity when there's two or even four and people end up fighting over it after just a couple generations.
Right, right. Here it took us a few thousand years to really fight. Yeah, we got there. But no, you're right. I'm saying the core tenets of the religion, what it's about, remain very strong. Right, exactly. And to get from Avraham to Mount Sinai is hundreds of years, and yet they build steadily through that. So, we need something. So this covenant, in order for this people to last, in order for Avram's relationship with Hashem to pass down to the next generation, to the next generation, and to thousands of years later, is that we need something that's going to cement that. The same way Avram does it is the way that we have to do it. You know, it's interesting because we pointed out that really, we don't really see us receiving mitzvot until we're a people. Right? That's why there's so few mitzvot in Bereishit. I have 613 mitzvot. There's three in the entire book. One-fifth of the Torah has three mitzvot, right? It's completely disproportional. Why? Because it's not really a mitzvah book. We're not really a people yet. We only receive the Torah once we're a people and we're at Mount Sinai. So why does this mitzvah stick? Right? There are other things that our forefathers do that we don't do. And we don't try to do. We don't think that they become mitzvahs for future generations. But this is the one thing that sticks. This is the one thing that Avraham does that we do as well. Why? Because it has to be. Because if Avram's going to cement his relationship with God, with Hashem, and that's going to pass on for the next generation, go for thousands of years, and stay linked from generation to generation, we need that same sign. It has to be that what we do now is what Avram did himself. And we need that one thing. And the bris is that one thing. The one thing that links us all the way back to Avram, generation to generation without a break. And that becomes that sign, that physical, it has to be, it can't be something tangential to us. Can't be, oh, it can't be that we wear red every Thursday. That's tangential, that's not, now this is the essence of who we are. Our physical bodies themselves are part of this process. So that's why for a covenant, this is chosen. So it's chosen partly because, like we said, this is the ultimate sign of perfection. We're perfecting the world, we're showing that we're part of perfection, that we can change and become better. And it also is in a place where that's going to have the strongest impact. But also needs to be something that's going to be long-lasting, going to be clear, and it's going to be different. And that also is very important. It has to be unique. If it's something that other people could do or would do on their own, then it also is not going to, it's not going to bring this point home. Because the covenant has to be for the many offspring.
If it's chop off your left finger, Bob the Butcher could have done that accidentally, right? There's no...
Right. Oh, well, but then also now we're just doing something right. Now we're hurting ourselves. Now that's really... You know, it has to be something that is going to be clear. It's going to be different. It's going to be long-lasting. Has to be to our essential selves. And also it's not going to be destructive, right? You're cutting off your fingers. Great, now, you know... We're already not good athletes. Give us another handicap. It's not fair.
McCorkle did that.
What?
McCorkle wanted to do that.
To what? To cut off their...
They want to show their toughness.
Oh, to show their toughness?
But now that a lot of people are getting circumcised who aren't Jewish...
So that's an interesting question. I was thinking about that. So, well, yeah, let's say that for the end. It's an interesting question because now it's probably more popular and common now than probably at any other point in human history. No? I mean, I'd say it's... You know,
in America, you don't see that in Europe or Africa or Asia, do you?
In Europe,
it's very bad. They don't have circumcision practically,
right?
Because people, the older generation, is afraid that what's happened in the Second World War.
Who Jews or non-Jews?
Jews.
No, but what about non-Jews? Do non-Jews?
Not the only time when there is infection.
Okay, so is it really only America that non-Jews as a whole?
Yes, and in Africa.
Yeah. Really?
In Africa too, I think.
Africa this?
I'm hearing it's on the decline again, so it's a trend.
It's a trend. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that.
Okay, that's very interesting. I guess I assume because in America it's like, you know, seen as pretty common. But you're right. So the question then still remains that if it's still so uncommon around the world, then that makes sense. Okay, I guess America really is a very Jewish country. That's the point, right? So it has to be unique. So there's a great midrash that Avraham, when he's given the commandment by God to circumcise, to have the bris milah, so he goes to three of his friends and he asks them, "What should I do? Should I do it or not?" That's the midrash says. He goes to three of his friends, and he asks them,
"You're
should
crazy,
I?"
Crazy, right?
So there's three friends, right? Every good, you always need three friends, right? Like you always need three. The wacky one, you have the sane one, right? So because there's always three friends. So they say that in movies that women, like movies with women, there's always a group of four friends. That's that's the pattern.
Sex and the City.
What?
Sex and the City.
Okay, so that's four friends. And there has to be four. I don't know. There's something about like four friends as being like a unit. So anyway. So he has his three friends. So he goes to Aner. And Aner says don't do it. Right?
Who?
Aner. Yeah, he says don't do it. It's going to be too painful. It's going to be difficult. Right? You shouldn't do it. Then he goes to his second friend, Eshkol. And Eshkol says, don't do it, but not because it's going to be too painful, because you'll stick out. People will hate you. People think you're strange. Don't do it. You're crazy. You're going to be too different. And then he goes to his friend, Mamre. And Mamre says, you have to do it because Hashem commanded you to do it. And in the end, he listens to Hashem. To Mamre, and then, you know, has the bris milah. So it's a very funny midrash, because it kind of paints Avraham in a strange light. That here he is, he's given the commandment by God, and he's asking his friends, like, should I do it? Like, just do it, right? You think he would just do it. So it ends up being that these three friends kind of represent the three different approaches that we can have to bris milah, and reasons why people don't do it. It's interesting, because these are things that you hear till today. And when you hear people who are against the bris milah, when you're against circumcision, so these are the two main reasons that you hear. Number one, why shouldn't you do it? It's barbaric, it's painful, it's you know, how could you do this to the child? I remember there's a whole Seinfeld, right, where Kramer steals the baby because he thinks it's barbaric to have a bris, right? So he goes to bris and steals the baby before they do the bris and tries to run away, right? And then number two is don't do it. Why? Because you're going to stick out, you're going to be different. Right? Don't stick out too much. Don't be too different. If you do this, it's going to be so obvious that you're Jewish. Right? And then the third friend, Mamre, says, no, the whole point is you have to be willing to give those two things up. Meaning, in order to have the relationship with Hashem, to have that covenant and to build on it, then number one, you have to be willing to be different. To be a committed Jew, you have to be willing to stick out and be a little different. Because there's going to be a lot of things that's going to be different. Right? When you have to leave work at 3 p.m. on a Friday in the winter, that's going to be different. When you have to try to explain to your coworker what Simchas Torah is and why you can't go into work that Monday, you're going to be a little different. When you can't eat certain things in the office, you're going to be a little different. So you have to be willing to be different in order to be Jewish. Number two is you have to be willing to sacrifice a little bit. It's going to be a little painful. It's going to be a little difficult. It's not always going to be easy. To be a committed Jew, you have to be ready. So these two reasons why his friends give not to do it end up really serving as kind of like the ultimate, you know, excuses are given throughout Jewish history why we had to give up being Jewish, or why it's too hard to be Jewish. We don't want to be different. It's too hard. It's too difficult. And then ultimately Mamre says, no, Hashem says to do it, so we do it. So the bris ends up symbolizing that as well. It's a little strange. It seems a little bit odd. The baby's crying. What are we doing here? Right? And, you know, look, I've been to a million brises. I fully understand the mitzvah. I completely support the mitzvah. But you know what? You're at a bris, and you see a little baby crying, and your heart goes out. I mean, there's no other way. You know, you feel a little like, oh, this...
But the little baby doesn't have to cry.
What?
The little baby doesn't have to cry.
I know, but there's just emotionally...
No, because...
You know, there's a reaction.
My mother said I never cried because they made a little nipple, dipped it in wine, stuck it in my
So you're right. No, you're right. So
I didn't feel
the thing. But...
I'm just saying, though, you go to a bris, and, you know, there's a little bit, it's a little bit disconcerting. Maybe it's just our modern sensitivities, I don't know. But there's a little bit about it that's a little bit disconcerting. In the end, logically, I know the baby's fine. They do it in the hospital, they do it here, it doesn't matter, it's all the same. We know why we have this mitzvah, an important mitzvah. But the Yetzer Hara, let's put it that way, let's put it better. The Yetzer Hara is going to tell you, this is a little strange, it's painful for the baby. Why are we doing this? This seems a little weird, right? But that's the point, right? Maybe you say that's the entire point. The point is, if you're going to be a committed Jew, if you're going to live up to this covenant and all these great things that Hashem is going to give us, the many offspring in the land of Israel and our peoplehood, then we have to be willing to sacrifice and we have to be able to do things that are a little bit different. Otherwise, this isn't going to work. So basically, it comes down to Hashem's making a deal with us. Hashem's saying, I'm ready to stick my neck out for you. I'm ready to treat you as a different kind of nation, right? You know what? You're not going to follow the rules of human history. Human, you know, empires are going to rise and fall, and there'll be the Greeks, and there'll be the Romans, and then there'll be this one, and there'll be that one. The Jewish people are going to survive all of that against all odds. You're going to be living in different countries. You're going to be spread out. You're going to be persecuted everywhere you are. You'll be kicked out of every country in the world, sometimes multiple times. And you know what? You're going to survive all of it and still remain successful, right? So I'm going to sacrifice for you. I'm going to treat you like you're different than anybody else. But here's the deal. You have to be willing to do the same thing for me. You have to be willing to be different like I'm treating you differently. You have to be willing to sacrifice for me like I'm ready to sacrifice for you. Right? I'll stick my neck out for you, but you have to be willing to sacrifice a little bit also. That's the quid pro quo.
This is in a very muted echo, gives every father of a son, it reflects the Akedah, it reflects the sacrifice of Isaac.
That's an interesting point, a little bit.
A little bit, just a tiny bit. But, you know, you're there, you're like, this is uncomfortable, this is difficult.
And for the mother, too.
Yeah.
For the mother, too. I mean, for mother and father, and maybe you say it can be more difficult for the mother to a certain extent. You know, seeing her baby cry, or, you know, even though we all know that the child will go through this anyway, still, it's something different about being there and seeing it. Right? You know, it's just, there's an emotional reaction to it, even though you know that it's the right thing, it's the best thing in all of us. So, still there's going to be a reaction to it. To a certain extent. So it really teaches that child, but it teaches everyone who's at the bris, and should impact them as well. Okay. Just make sure I'm not missing anything. Okay, so let's ask. So, who asked the question about why not women? That was you. Okay. So, two things. One is something the Gemara says. One is thing that I was thinking about. So, we'll start with the thing the Gemara says, because that's obviously more likely to be correct. Is correct. This is what I say, which, take it or leave it. The Gemara has an interesting term. The Gemara says, Isha Kaman Demahala Damya. That a woman, it's as if she was already circumcised. Okay? So, we can understand that as being that a lot of the issues we talked about are not quite as challenging for women. Right? Sexuality is different for men and women. The temptations of sexuality are different for men and women. And their ability to stay, you know, as part of the family versus separating from the fold, men are much more likely to be a little bit more rebellious and out there and kind of breaking away. Right? I mean, the rule of thumb is you end up living where your wife is from, right? Or your wife wants to live, right? Because that's kind of where your pull is, right? Where she wants to live is where you end up living, because if she's not happy where you are, you're not going to be living there very long, right? That's just the way it is, right? All my friends who grew up in Miami with me, and they all said, oh, I'm going to get married, and we're all going to move back to Miami. And they're all living in New Jersey, or in Teaneck, you know, in New York, or, right? They ended up living where their wife was from. That's the way it is. And every year I speak to them, and they always say to me, I think in like 2 years we're going to move back to Miami.
Next year in Miami.
Maybe next year we'll move back, right? And 10 years later, they're not moving anytime soon. There are a few who've done it. I have to say, there are a handful who've done it, and it's impressive. But it took them about 5 or 6 years of slowly wearing down their wives. But usually, you're not going to win that. So that's one perspective. The second perspective is the relationship between the mother and son. It's interesting. Just this Friday night, we had guests over. Because my wife and I always talk about the differences between, you know, a mother and father's relationship with daughters and sons. So it's a very interesting thing. So we have three daughters. So my wife always says that, I might be the softy, but she says I'm the softy. And I say it's because they're all girls. If there's a boy, I'd be a little tougher with them, right? And you'd be the softy. So you'd be the softy. We had sons. So it's interesting. So we had guests over Friday night who have, they have a boy and a girl. Who's the older one? The boy was the older. The boy was like 5, and the girl's like 2.5. So my wife asks her over dinner and said, ask the mother, can I ask you a question? Do you treat him differently than you treat her? Right? She was curious. And, you know, she's done this before. And she looks at her and she just says, very honest, she says, completely different. She says, I give, like, I'm much more relaxed with the son. I have much more patience with him. I'm totally differently. And when it comes to my daughter, I'm much tougher, I'm much stricter, I'm much, like, more on top of it. I have a lot less patience. Like, I just have totally different relationships with both of them. So you could argue that to a certain extent, the son having the bris impacts the mother even more emotionally than the father. That's, you know, that's what I was thinking about that based on that experience. That could be that the mother and son are linked very, very closely, right? And you just kind of see that a lot. You know, that's kind of the way society, mothers and sons, right? They're linked in a very kind of unique way. Fathers and sons always have a bit of a struggle. Mothers and daughters, they always have a bit of a struggle, always a back and forth. But the mother, you know, fathers and daughters, they're just like, you know, you don't hear about them being struggling so much. Mothers and daughters, and I was like, fathers and daughters, right? It's a very different relationship. So in that sense, it could be that the fact that it's through the son really impacts the mother, you know, in a more meaningful way. So anyway, something I was thinking about, take it or leave it, but that's one thing I was like. All right, any questions before we wrap up? Okay, perfect class, no questions, great. Okay, so we will continue next week, next Wednesday night, with mitzvah number 3. And you can listen to this to review online at yutorah.org. The greatest Torah in the world.